Dedicated to the survival of American democracy in an increasingly dangerous world, this is Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney, acted as Assistant Secretary of Defense for International Security Policy under President Ronald Reagan, founder and president of the Center for Security Policy in Washington, D.C., the go-to man for defense and foreign policy issues, joined by the greatest minds in the security policy business, the special forces in the war of ideas at Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.
Hello, folks. It's Jim Hansen. Welcome to Secure Freedom Radio. The world is a dangerous place, and it's been so since the dawn of time. It falls on those of us who can to help make it less so. That is one of the primary responsibilities of the U.S. president, to preserve, protect, and defend the Constitution, and by extension, the American people. Over the past 8 years, President Barack Obama has failed miserably at keeping Americans safe and has demonstrably made the world less safe. If you wanted to sum up his national security legacy, it would be the Hollywood image of a guy who turns and runs towards the camera and gets blown off his feet as everything behind him explodes in a massive fireball. There is no place on earth, and certainly not in these United States, where you could say things have gotten safe. Jihadists have slaughtered Americans here at the Boston Marathon, in San Bernardino at a holiday party, and another horrific massacre at a nightclub in Orlando, among other places. The carnage of ISIS has led most of us to simply stop paying attention to their outrages, because we simply cannot fathom that sustained level of barbarity. Europe has been flooded with blood from slaughter after slaughter, and yet they and we continue to bring refugees and migrants in when no one can tell the innocence from the evil. Both Russia and China have become far more militaristic and expanded their provocations without any meaningful response from the United States. But there is one act of national security malfeasance that leads the list of Obama's awfulness. Iran. Somehow, somewhere, he got it in his head that Iran was a partner for peace. Now, you would be hard-pressed to find a more wrong-headed, naive, and contradicted by facts and experience idea in the world. But he seized upon it and spent the last 8 years empowering the mullahs of Iran. Now, anyone with an above room temperature IQ has no trouble understanding the danger and track record of literal death to America this regime has perpetrated. But somehow, this escaped Obama, and he made quite possibly the worst agreement in modern history with the Iran nuclear deal. Now, the craziest regime in the region has pallet loads of cash and prizes, and they're using them to spread death and destruction far and wide as a result. President Trump is going to have to deal with this madness, and he has said unequivocally during the campaign that he will not be treated like the submissive beta male that President Obama presented to them. He'll be facing an Iran that has been readmitted into what passes for polite society in the world. They are essentially running the Iraqi government in Baghdad. The Shia militias they back and operate are running rampant in the Sunni regions of Iraq as the push to crush ISIS goes forward without any significant U.S. leadership. Now, these militias, the same ones that killed U.S. troops for years, the same ones that used Iranian-provided explosively formed projectile IEDs to kill and maim thousands of U.S. troops, are now taking advantage of the free rein they have to do some good old-fashioned sectarian slaughter, and tens of thousands of civilians all across Anbar province have paid the price. Iran has also invited the Russians much closer, and as Adam Credo of the Washington Free Beacon will discuss next segment, they're planning a major arm deal with the Russians, and they'll be using some of that ransom and payoff money from the Iran deal to buy a bunch of weaponry that will be used for no good. So whereas President Obama inherited an Iraq with a stable government, a defeated insurgency, and the actual possibility of stability, his cut and run from Iraq means President Trump will inherit a region littered with the dead, tens of millions of displaced refugees, and Iran, Russia, and Turkey carving up the pie. Thanks, Obama. Now, the Iranians have been harassing U.S. warships all through the region. And let's not forget, they literally kidnapped a crew of U.S. sailors and, in flagrant violation of all the laws of war, paraded them in front of the world like it was a Roman triumph. Then, worse yet, they suffered no repercussions. They got away with it, and we submitted. That is not something that would go unchallenged with Donald Trump as commander-in-chief. It would almost certainly end up with some overmatched Iranian ships as oil slicks on the water. And that may be exactly what is needed. But we can also hope that the mere presence of an actual leader who leads from the front in the commander-in-chief chair will give the Iranians pause. You see, weakness and submission, a la Obama, embolden tyrants, including the Iranians. Trump seems more of the Ronald Reagan mold of peace through strength. And time again, that has proved to be a winning strategy. But it means that a firm hand regarding the Iranians will be required. This includes a complete renegotiation of the excremental Iran deal. It was a capitulation combined with payoffs, secret side deals, and no advice or consent from the U.S. Senate as required by the Constitution for any treaty of this magnitude. And it was a treaty. President Obama cheated the system and the American people and the world by pretending it was not. President Trump should resubmit that abomination to the U.S. Senate and let them vote it down, then take it right back to the Iranians with a promise they will no longer have free rein to flout the lack of teeth in a deal that did nothing to slow down their nuclear program and paid them tons of money, which they're using as the largest state sponsor of terrorism. The Iranian nuclear program has not been slowed one bit by the faux restrictions this deal holds, partly because the deal actually had little in it to stop the Iranians, and partly because the Iranians are flagrantly violating what few prohibitions there are in it, with absolutely no penalties from the feckless Obama team. Thankfully, John Kerry seems to be spending the end of this administration communing with penguins in Antarctica, a good place for him. The danger of a nuclear-armed Iran is readily understandable, but the rest of the folks in the region, like Saudi Arabia and the UAE, have good reason to fear a resurgent Iran with or without nukes, and they are certainly not trusting that non-agreement to stop the Iranian push for an Obama bomb, as our colleague Fred Flights at the Center for Security Policy terms it in his book of that name. And incidentally, do read that to learn just how egregiously awful that deal truly is. You can get it on Amazon. Iran is feeling pretty froggy right now. And well, they should. They smoked Obama and John Kerry like cheap cigars at the deal-making table. And they have taken advantage of that to become the dominant power in the Middle East. So that is mess number one that President Trump will be facing. And while I have a positive feeling he will deal with it orders of magnitude better than Obama, it is still a huge challenge, and it will take all of the new commander-in-chief's leadership and deal-making ability to confront this and get the Iranians back in check. Coming up next, we're going to talk with Adam Credo of the Washington Free Beacon about several articles he's written concerning threats from the Iranian military to a new President Trump, the deal they're making with Russia to buy a whole bunch of the machinery of war, and what President Trump can do to stop them. This is Jim Hansen. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Visit us at facebook.com/securefreedom with Frank Gaffney. You're listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney from the nation's capital in Washington, D.C.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. Right now, we're going to talk with Adam Credo, senior writer for the Washington Free Beacon, and a guy who has been keeping a solid eye on our not-friends, Iran. Now, there has been, some sort of idea in the Obama administration that Iran could be an ally, that they were a partner for peace, that we could work with them, and for some reason, we should empower them as a larger hegemon in the region. That's always been absurd, crazy, and counterproductive, and the entire region is feeling the effect of an empowered Iran. But now we've got a change in leadership in the United States. We've got a gentleman who has said on the campaign trail that he's not going to take the provocations and take the actions of the Iranians in the same way that President Obama has simply submitted to him. So, Adam, I'd like to ask you about a piece you wrote saying that the Iranians heard him and that their chief of staff of the Iranian armed forces said, yeah, bring it on, more or less. He said, you know, don't even try that because we're Iran and somehow we're tough guys. Is there any chance they're literally willing to stand up to a guy like Trump if he decides to play a little brinksmanship with them?
I actually don't think they would, and I would say privately the Iranians are very worried right now after the Trump election, and I think this is kind of a way for them to test the waters, see what the reaction is. We know the Iranians like to talk tough, but when it comes down to action, usually not as much, especially if it comes down to the United States. So to me, what I see behind the bolster here is a fear among the Iranians that they're not going to have Obama anymore, their allies like John Kerry that really have bent over backwards to them. They're going to have somebody that's going to take more of a hard line. And look, when the Iranians harass and go after the Americans in the Persian Gulf, I don't think that we're just going to lay there and take it anymore. I think that they're worried there's going to be a true response. So this is kind of them putting the bluster and flexing their might before the Trump administration. But once he comes in, I don't know we're going to see that as much.
They gained so much prestige by being readmitted to the world powers through the Iran deal, becoming part of the banking systems again, you know, getting the plane loads of cash flown their way. They were flying high during the Obama administration. And I think you're right. That may have come to an end. But let's talk about what else is going on, because they've got other friends. All right, they happen to have a fairly good relationship with the Russians. They were letting them fly planes out of Iran to attack targets in Syria. You also write about a potential arms deal between Iran and Russia. What are they looking at? Because that could be pretty scary.
Well, you're right. And I think it's very safe to say that since the Iran nuclear deal last year, the Russians and the Iranians have become very close with one another. That nuclear deal kind of paved the way for Iran to re-enter the community of nations and become more of a legitimate player, which allowed Russia and Iran to go forward with arms deals. We've already seen some of that go through. The Russians recently delivered the S-300 missile system. That's a defensive missile system that is advanced and was recently given to Tehran after years of debate when Iran was more of a international pariah before the nuclear deal. It was difficult for Russia But after that, they were able to deliver the system. And now we're seeing more of that. Look, the Russians have already guaranteed that they'll build new nuclear reactors. Those are light water reactors for the Iranians. And now they're saying, essentially, here's a menu of military hardware, tanks, artillery, things of this nature, planes for the war fleet. Take off the menu, take what you want, and it looks like they're aiming at around a $10 billion arms pact. And I think it's just going to be one of many, because now the alliance is really Iran, Russia, China. Those are kind of the three players now.
And the thing is, we enabled this by freeing up all the money, by sending those plane loads of cash, and by allowing them to throw off whatever constraints the sanctions had put on them, you know, to keep them kind of in line. And the thing is, if Russia gives them these weapons, okay, maybe the SA-300s are defensive in nature. They're missile, you know, defense, they're air defense. They may stop someone from coming in and blowing up their nuclear program, which is the main reason to have them. But the rest of that stuff is going to find its way into offensive actions by an aggressive Iran that wants to maintain the Shia crescent that they now see going all the way to the Mediterranean. You know, they see themselves as the ones running this area, and I think there was no one to stop them for the past 8 years. So given all that, you know, weaponry, they are quite likely to use it to finish off that Shia crescent.
Look, I think you're absolutely correct. That's always the end goal for the Iranians, that bolstering the regime and bolstering the hardline ideology. But you make a very interesting point when you differentiate between offensive and defensive weaponry. Under the nuclear accord, actually, it's a small thing that not many people know about. The United States, the UN Security Council, has the right to veto these cells. The Iranians technically are only allowed to purchase defensive weaponry, like that S-300 system. While deadly, it's classified as defensive. They're not allowed to purchase offensive weaponry, and if this deal goes through, the United States, most likely under the Trump administration, Obama will be gone by then, could veto this sale.
Is there a chance this could be one of Obama's last here you go, buddy, kind of actions? Could they actually ink this deal soon enough to let our UN ambassador sit on the sidelines again and not veto it?
They could. Yeah, that's certainly a possibility, too, depending on how fast they move forward with this. I like to think it would be more under a Trump administration, but it is fair to say that during the last arms deal, the S-300, the Obama administration made no moves to veto it.
Well, unfortunately, I have a dim view of what's likely to happen in the waning days of the Obama administration, and he's more likely to double down on the badness of the Iran deal than fix it, since that's all he's got left. So hopefully they won't be able to get it done, but I fear they might. Now, what else have we got going on with Iran, though, that is something the folks should keep an eye on? I mean, obviously, I consider them the main threat in the entire region. But is there a way for a new president to kind of push back without having to turn this into, you know, a force-on-force venture? What kind of leverage do we have on them?
Well, look, we still have the ability to pass sanctions. The House of Representatives, actually later today, is going to vote on a bill that would essentially ban companies, U.S. companies like Boeing and others, from selling Iran U.S.-made aircraft. Iran has a history of buying commercial airlines from the U.S. and then converting them and using them in the Air Force and their military. The Obama administration admits that this is the case, but still says we're obligated under the deal to let them buy commercial jets. This bill would make that impossible by preventing the administration from granting the licenses that enable a company like Boeing to sell these planes. So these are the things we're going to see play out in the next couple of months before Trump gets in there. Once he's in office, I think all bets are off, and we're going to see the Iranians treated in a much more confrontational manner. That is, when they are a bad actor, we will not only call them on it, but potentially take action against them.
That would be a welcome change, my friend, because they have been running rampant and causing everybody trouble. Adam Credo, senior writer for the Washington Free Beacon. Keep an eye on everything he does because it is always informative. Up next, we will be talking with Diana West. This is Jim Hansen, and you're listening to Secure Freedom Radio.
Now more with Frank Gaffney.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio with Jim Hansen. We're talking now with Diana West, who is a nationally syndicated columnist, a blogger at dianawest.net, and author of a couple great books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal. Diana, I wanted to check in and get your opinion on something you've been writing about, and that is whether or not in Hillary Clinton's supposed winning of the popular vote in this election, if the folks who actually voted and were counted were all American citizens, which last time I read was a requirement to actually vote in a U.S. election that you had to be a citizen of the United States. But as it turns out, apparently, given the president's exhortations to anyone who is here, you can go ahead and vote and there will be no repercussions. And some research that's been done sounds like an awful lot of illegal aliens might have voted and probably gave Hillary whatever margin above Donald Trump she may have gotten.
That is exactly what looks to have happened, Jim. It's not smoke. It's not a joke. It's based in patterns that we've seen in earlier elections. There was a study conducted by three political scientists out of George Mason and Old Dominion University in Virginia, back looking at the 2008 and 2010 elections. And, of course, the 2008 being the presidential year would be a very good point of comparison. And what they determined in a paper that came out in an academic journal just almost 2 years ago was that as many as 1.2 million illegal aliens, or what they call non-citizen votes, took place in the 2008 election. That was their best guess, and on the conservative side, looking at the data that they actually examined, it's a very solid kind of number to be considering. And as we look going forward to this election, two cycles later, we know that there are more illegal aliens in the country. We know that there are fewer checks in the various states that have eliminated the kinds of picture ID checks and other kinds of voter ID precautions in many of the states that actually were once Hillary Clinton won. And we can take that number and build on it. And I'm hoping to see that kind of political scientist once again delve into these figures, but I think we can assume that a very large chunk of these votes come from non-citizens.
I don't think there's any chance that the 2008 election had more illegals voting than this one, especially given the Democrat platform seemed to be in large part consisting of saying, yeah, anybody, anyone, you're all citizens, you're new Americans. Obama's policy, he no longer has not even undocumented folks anymore. They're new Americans is his policy. And then the speeches he gave in the run-up to the election, where he literally said, it doesn't matter who you are. If you're here, you're a citizen. Go ahead and vote. There will be no problem with that. I mean, it was, I just, that was criminal in my mind.
Yes, it is criminal. I mean, it is a criminal act also to vote as a non-citizen. These are crimes. We've also seen already in this cycle, we've seen the voter fraud watchdogs at groups like True the Vote estimating figures in the realm of 3 million non-citizen votes in the 2016 election. This makes all the sense in the world, given the things you're talking about and given this encouragement. And given also the open border we've had for these many years, whereby we've seen these vast numbers, these demographic shifts coming out of Mexico, Central America, elsewhere, bringing in all kinds of aliens that have disappeared into the country and you know, certainly can end up with the kind of documentation that brings them to a local ballot. So this is a real problem, and certainly the Trump administration should be focusing on voter fraud as one of its issues in order to safeguard elections of the future.
Okay, now, well, let's talk about it. Whether or not they voted, it didn't shift the Electoral College, which, according to the Constitution, is how we elect presidents. So the left can continue to throw their tantrum about whether or not Hillary got more of a popular vote. I don't think she got a more popular vote of U.S. citizens. But now we have a president-elect. January 20th, we will see President Obama walk out of the White House, thankfully, and President Trump walk in. What is he going to do about this problem? We've had an open border, as you mentioned. We've had essentially a sign hanging on the southern border that said, sure, come on in. You know, we've got crappy jobs for you to do. What are we going to do now to secure the border and to deal with this issue overall?
Well, I think there are so many tools that President-elect Trump can use, and when he becomes president, Trump can use to address this issue. Of course, he's dwelling right now or focusing right now on criminal aliens. He's talked a lot about sanctuary cities. This becomes kind of the point of the sword at addressing this problem. One, the lawlessness of city managers, mayors, who are permitting this kind of lawlessness to dominate their cities, to focus on the illegal people in their cities as opposed to the American citizens. And, of course, the criminal problem. That becomes, I think, what he's looking at first. We also have the employer situation. When you use E-Verify and other tools, employing illegal aliens becomes virtually impossible as a matter of record. So this becomes a very huge tool because if these people coming here for jobs are coming here to work. If the jobs are not there, if the employers are unable to offer them, if they go to jail or suffer fines or other kinds of penalties for employing illegal aliens, you are going to see just the carrot eliminated in terms of drawing people who are coming here to work and in terms of starting to rebalance the American wage system, which is terribly skewed by this source of essentially quasi, I mean, you say crappy jobs, these are great jobs for these people, but they definitely depress the wage scale in America and essentially allow businesses to feed off of a quasi-slave labor. I mean, this is really a moral issue that is very seldom developed in that way. I think it is a moral issue to exploit people coming from other countries who have much lower standards of living and much lower ideas of what a standard of living should be in our country, in our midst, and it skews our whole system. So these become some of the very simple tools that you use to enforce the laws that are already on the books. This doesn't require a whole new scat of laws. They're all there. But different means of enforcement and different seriousness at the top. So much of this is emotional in a way, Jim, in the sense that if you know that this president will be shoring up law enforcement, shoring up Border Patrol, having their back, protecting them, as well as enforcing these laws and requiring American employers and businesses and homes to enforce these same laws, you're going to have a completely different psychological mood in the country, whereby many of these issues will resolve themselves as people, yes, self-deport, go back where it's easier, reunite with their families south of the border, etc. So many of these things do not require any kind of police action. They just require enforcement of the law and a steady hand, and you will see a great shifting and sorting of the situation. The criminal aspect and so on will require state force and so on, but even that will start a trend.
A lot of it is emotional. I mean, people, a large segment of the population and a lot of decent people who disagree with an open border can still look at the folks who came here and said, okay, they're hardworking, they do a lot of things, and the bulk of them aren't criminals. You know, they're doing things. So it makes it difficult to say, well, why can't we help them? You know, they just want a better life. And okay, all of those things are true. But if you make that point, and if that is your point, then we would have the same obligation or open border to anybody in the world who was in a lesser situation and wanted to come to America and improve their life. And then we cease to be a nation. And at some point, we have to have borders, we have to have a nation, and we have to enforce our laws. And I think that's something we have unfortunately lost sight of. And as you said, there are means to do it, and hopefully we will employ them. Diana West, thank you so much. Excellent commentary, as always. Folks, grab her books, Death of the Grown-Up and American Betrayal, and check out her work at dianawest.net. This is Jim Hansen. We're doing Secure Freedom Radio. Up next, we'll be talking with Michael Cutler.
Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio. Go to securefreedomradio.org today. It's your freedom. It's your country. Frank Gaffney's Secure Freedom Radio.
Welcome back to Secure Freedom Radio. We're going to talk right now with Michael Cutler, who is a retired senior special agent from the former Immigration and Naturalization Services. He hosts the radio talk show The Michael Cutler Hour Friday evenings on Blog Talk Radio, and he's a senior fellow at Californians for Population Stabilization. Well, Michael, we seem to have a guy who just got elected president who shares a number of positions with you as far as how we could take care of the large and growing problem we've had with illegal immigration. So now we've heard a few things, but if you were going to tell the guy moving into the White House what the first thing he should be doing is, what would you say?
I would say that we need to create an immigration task force. You know, we do not have adequate resources or assets for enforcing the immigration laws from within the interior of the United States. We hear so much about the border, and I know Donald Trump has been speaking quite a bit about the Mexican border. Now, make no mistake, that border must be secured. I mean, this isn't an if or maybe we should. Has to be. But, you know, I also write for Front Page Magazine as well as The Social Contract. And in my articles, I have focused on many of the other components of this failing immigration system. You know, we have failure by design where immigration has been concerned because too many people from both political parties are being, if you want to put it bluntly, bribed by campaign contributions by people who are literally and figuratively making out like bandits by exploiting the immigration system for their own purpose, being led primarily with the U.S. Chamber of Commerce that wants an unlimited supply of cheap labor. They want to bring in more H-1B visas. They want more foreign students. And there's many other groups in that long line of people feeding at the trough. So what we need to do is instill integrity into the immigration system. Of course, if we can keep people from running the Mexican border, that's a good first step, but only a first step. We also need to know that when aliens do get past either the Border Patrol or they manage to enter the United States, having been inspected by inspectors at the airport, and they did that job for the first 4 years of my 30-year career before I became an agent, if they can get past the inspector, again, they're home free. So what really we need to do is to create a notion, a sense in the minds of anybody who would come here, that if you're here in violation of law, there's a very good chance you're going to get caught. The same way that we do with drunk drivers, with people who text while driving. You know, the notion that we can't deport 11 million, and I think the number is probably more than 30 million, when we say, well, we can't deport them all, so we may as well give them some kind of status, is waving the white flag of surrender. It also undermines national security. The first thing I would love for Mr. Trump and the people working with him should do is look at the 9/11 Commission report. And, you know, I provide a testimony to the 9/11 Commission. And the Commission found that first and foremost, it was failures of the immigration system that enabled terrorists to enter the United States, embed themselves, and then go about their deadly preparations. And none of them ran the Mexican border, at least none of the 9/11 hijackers. They all came through international airports. And then disappeared in the crowd. The other thing I would do is start to create an immigration task force using other agents, the way I was part of the drug task force for half my career. Take people from the IRS, take people from the U.S. Marshal Service, from ATF, bring them over and work in an immigration task force as you start to hire many more agents. We have about 5,000 ICE agents, immigration and customs agents, right now. That number is ridiculous. We have over 45,000 people at TSA. We have over 20,000 Border Patrol agents. And of the 5,000, by the way, who work for ICE, half are doing customs work, which has no relevance to immigration work. So we're down to probably fewer than 3,000 honest-to-God immigration agents for the entire United States. New York City has 35,000 police officers. And one thing that we have to do, you know, when Donald Trump said that we've got to have extreme vetting, I would seriously urge him to cancel the visa waiver program. There's no vetting there that really meets anybody's standard. That's item number one. Item number two, I would also consider going after immigration fraud, the people who lie on applications for immigration benefits. Immigration fraud was identified by the 9/11 Commission as a chief embedding tactic, a way of hiding in plain sight. I spent years on the frauds unit, and in fact, my very first case involved a fraud case. A young man who came here from Israel altered his visa and apparently just wanted to work. Well, I did digging. I played a hunch. My very first case, the guy was here to get money to fund a terrorist attack in Israel. By playing that hunch, we ultimately prevented the bombing of an oil refinery at Haifa. So it was an eye-opener for me, and I think a lot of my colleagues, that here you had a 24-year-old kid, so to speak, coming to the United States on an altered visa, whose ultimate goal was to carry out a violent attack, and the Israelis ultimately caught six people who were going to carry out that attack. So this is really where we need to be. We need to understand this isn't about xenophobia. We also need to go after sanctuary cities. Sanctuary cities not only threaten the lives and safety of the residents within those towns by turning those cities into magnets for fugitives, terrorists, and criminals. I mean, when people run the border, there's a reason they don't come through the front door. They know they couldn't come through the front door because of some stuff in their background. Sanctuary cities could easily, and I mean really easily, become a staging area for terrorists who want to launch attacks anywhere in the United States. You set up shop in a sanctuary city, you put your plan in motion, you hop in a car or a truck or whatever, and you drive a couple of hundred miles to wherever it is you want to carry out that dastardly deed, and we have a problem.
I want to dig into a couple things you said, though. You said you would end the visa waiver program. Now, for folks who don't know, that means members of the EU, citizens of the EU, or in many cases, anyone in the EU, does not have to get a visa to come to the United States. It's an agreement we have with them that says we're all friends, we can all just get along, so you don't need to get a visa to come here. Now, that's good for the folks from the EU that we want coming here. The problem is the EU has let in millions of unvetted, undocumented, unknown refugees, migrants, and many jihadists among them, and they have no idea who's who among that bunch. So once they get any papers from the EU, they become eligible for that program, and allowing those folks to come here without knowing it is absurd.
Well, they have to be citizens. They have to carry a European passport or other passports from other countries.
That's a low bar, though.
But we also have the problem with first generation, as we've seen with the jihadists. And by the way, on 9/11, we had 26 such visa waiver countries. Because of the efforts of the Chamber of Commerce and their Discover America partnership, we now have 38 visa waiver countries. And what's interesting is that when the issue of terrorism came up, the Congress changed the law to say that if you commit an act of terror, or if you commit visa fraud in conjunction with an act of terror, the penalty is 25 years in jail, which I agree with. Visa fraud carries a serious penalty. Aliens who come under the visa waiver program don't face any such charge because there's no visa involved. We are undermining our own tough legislation to protect America from terrorists. Look, we've got to get serious. Visas can also provide you with wonderful investigative leads if you're trying to track somebody down as an agent. We always try to get our hands on the visa applications, although back then State Department tended to, pardon me, eliminate those applications way too quickly. But when you could get your hands on it, the applicant fills out a form with 40 questions. Every one of those questions is a potential investigative lead. There's many ways that visa application and the visa process really enhances national security. And you look at Massawi, the 20th hijacker. You look at Reed, the Brit who tried to set off his shoe bombs. They were able to get on airplanes without getting visas. So, you know, it made it that much easier for them to board an airliner. If the visa was required and they couldn't get a visa, they couldn't have gotten on the airplanes that they came on. So, I mean, this really enhances safety many ways. I think we're being foolish and short-sighted, and the Congress and politicians are placating the Chamber of Commerce, but the risk is, in my judgment, far too great.
Michael, let's hope that the folks who are coming into power in January are paying attention, because there was a lot of very good ideas and solid reasoning from a guy who's been on the front lines of our fight to keep the country safe and to keep folks who should not be coming in from coming in. That's going to wrap up Secure Freedom Radio for today. This is Jim Hansen. We'll be back tomorrow with more ammunition in the war for the free world.
From the nation's capital, you've been listening to Secure Freedom Radio with Frank Gaffney.